Welcome to the program for Thursday, August 30th, 2012 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It's Industry Chatter every Thursday in the 3 o'clock hour. And my guest today is Mark Weber, president of the U.S. sector for NetApp. Mark, great to have you in the studio. Thanks for having me in.
Appreciate it.
Happy to do it. Tell me what NetApp does for customers in the federal government, and I take from your title also in the rest of the public sector.
You bet. Well, NetApp's a large company, about a $7 billion company, and we're a provider of products, mostly hardware and software products that do storage and data management. So we're a piece of that IT stack that people are putting in.
You are, I imagine, then heavily involved in one of the biggest buzzwords of 2012, which is big data.
We love big data because that's a lot of storage, right? So, yes, you bet. We're in the middle of that every day. You know, and big data is a pretty high-level word, so there's a lot of pieces to that.
Okay, so give me the kind of the thumbnail sketch of what big data means to somebody who's not in the business of managing data on a daily basis.
So big data, really, the way we define it is it's massive amounts of data, and it comes in all different forms, and it's data that really comes in unstructured format and structured format. Now 30% of the federal government's data is unstructured, meaning it's not coming from some database or some spreadsheet. It's in some other form. So they're trying to figure out how to handle that, how to manage that, what to do with it, right?
Yeah. What's the evolution process here? Why is all of a sudden big data such a prominent term, something we hear a lot about? What has happened to the data flow over the past, say, year to 5 years that all of a sudden it's big where we didn't refer to it that way before?
Well, so the data growth these days, any industry analyst will tell you it's 40 to 50% data growth a year, right? So with that kind of overflowing amount of data, either data is going to become a big burden to the IT organization or a propellant to your business, right? If you know how to mine that data and get value out of it, oh my gosh, what kind of business value you're going to get out of that? And I don't mean just a commercial business. I mean the federal government. If you're an intelligence agency and you know how to mine that data, you can do a lot of good things with it. Or it can be a pain in the butt, right, if you don't know how to get data out of it. Right?
Why, are we collecting more data than we did historically, or are we just able to organize it and process it more efficiently than in the past? Or why is this all of a sudden on the radar screens of people across government?
Well, you have to look at the types of information we're collecting. So a typical sheet of paper doesn't take up a lot of storage, right? The text. Now we get a lot of voice, a lot of video, and that takes up a lot more room, a lot more space in storage, right? And it's unstructured, so it's not as easy to sort through, find the information in there. So it creates problems on how to mine that, right? We look at big data in three different formats, right? There's three different aspects. The analytics of it, kind of the bandwidth, and the content. So when I say that, the analytics, how do you gain intelligence out of that? How do you mine it? It's three different problem sets. The bandwidth, first of all, how do you suck all that data in? You can imagine some unmanned vehicle or all the cameras now. They're sucking in a lot more data. When they used to have one camera, now you got lots. And the content is, where do you put this stuff? How long do you keep it? What kind of format? You know, and can you buy enough storage to retain everything you're collecting? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of the ABCs of big data.
How much of that is a policy discussion and how much of it is a technology discussion? It sounds like all of the things that you talk about there are all things that are technologically people are quite capable of doing if they want to.
So I believe the answer, Francis, is both. It is technology because a terabyte of storage from one company versus another company is not a terabyte, meaning there's a lot of technologies in order to take that data and store it more efficiently, you know, parse through it, dedupe the data, right? So there is a technology aspect that allow you to be much more efficient. There's a huge policy. How long do you retain it? What do you retain? If you retained every footage of video, you can't buy enough storage. There's not enough money to do it, not enough space. So you have to have policies on what is it you're going to keep.
How do you effectively address the policy part of that? What's the decision-making process, prioritization, all of those elements?
So, you know, we're an IT provider, so clearly we'll add guidance and, you know, some information to that. But really that's done by the federal agencies, and it's drastically different on who you are. If you're a civilian, DOD or Intel. The policies are significantly different. And your mission, right?
Yeah. So. The agencies that are at that point right now, when you offer them guidance and you offer them input, what kinds of things are they usually – what kinds of decisions, other than the ones that you mentioned, are they usually trying to make?
Well, mostly they're trying to make a cost-benefit analysis, mm-hmm. right? Do they have enough money, and where do they keep it in that life cycle of their storage management, right? I mean, there's their front-end, more expensive storage, and then there's that migration into Tier 2, Tier 3 type environments, right? Mm-hmm. So how do we help them get it off of big expensive storage, which you need to be able to suck it in, down into something more cost-affordable, right?
What's the difference in the tiers that you're referring to?
Well,
there.
Most of it, you don't want to touch the data. Once you lay it out there in your storage environment, you want it to automatically be able to tier down into the right place. Mm-hmm. So that's a technology advantage for certain companies that can offer that, right? Because if you have to manage that and move that massive amounts of big data around with people, you're not going to get it right. Right? So you let the technology work that and settle where it belongs. Some of that's accessibility, how often you touch it, kind of figures out where it lies. Some of it is you tag it on how important it is, right? So there's a lot of technology that can go into managing that into the right tiers.
But even step back a little bit further mm-hmm. and explain the differences amongst the tiers. I imagine tier one is the stuff that you have either ingested most recently or potentially will use the most?
Yes, right? I mean, so there's certain things that you can leave on, you know, solid state disk, right, which is going to have the fastest available, right? And you can have a methodology with rules that allow you to kind of hard code that kind of data in there. But naturally, if it's, you know, the different auto tiering mechanisms will migrate data further down that pipeline, call it, as you don't access it, mm-hmm. right? I mean, if you haven't looked at something in 6 months, you would hope it's gotten into the archival type world, right?
What makes the different tiers of storage less expensive as you go down in the tiers?
Well, clearly there's the hardware aspect to it, meaning disk drives are not all the same, right? Some are fiber channel, some are SATA, some are, you know, I don't mean to use protocol and terminology,
okay. No,
but, you know, disk drives are not all the same. Some of them are faster and more reliable, and they're more expensive. Some of them are less expensive, right? I mean, some of them are exponentially cost different. Solid state, like flash, is a lot more expensive than a cheap drive you might buy at, you know, a SATA drive. So
how much are people at agencies thinking about all of the various aspects that we're talking about here? Or are we still at the point with big data that we were at maybe 3 years ago with cloud computing, where everybody's still just trying to get a sense of exactly what the terms mean and what the implications are and what's the ROI kind of thing?
Well, you know, NetApp's in the storage business, so we're dealing with storage specialist type people at each of these agencies. So my view is, you know, these guys know what they're doing. Most of the agencies realize they have a data problem, too much data. So they're analyzing. They're looking in the market, and they're, you know, tackling the problem. I wouldn't say we got a lot of ignorant people. I'm sure some of them are. But for the most part, I see good behavior in people looking long term. One thing they can't do is predict how much data they're going to have next year. It's almost impossible, Francis, right?
We'll talk more about that.
So they
got
to have a plan,
yeah.
Right?
I want to talk about that planning process when we come back. My guest is Mark Weber, a president of the U.S. public sector for NetApp on Industry Chatter on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Back in a moment.
Agencies protect themselves against impending threats of national security from financial crimes across the globe? The Honorable Juan Zarate, noted national security expert, and Frank Weichert, former senior advisor on terrorist finance with the FBI, weigh in with host Jane Norris on Deloitte's Fed Central, Thursday, September 6th and 20th at 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m.
Soon this little baby I'm singing to sleep will start to walk. Before I know it, I'll be dropping her off at school, beaming when she walks up to accept her diploma. or holding back tears as she takes those big steps down the aisle. But before she takes all those steps, she and thousands like her will need you to take yours. Join March for Babies to help make her steps possible.
March for Babies!
Start your team today at marchforbabies.org.
The nation's largest intelligence event returns to Orlando, Florida, October 8th through 11th. USGIF's GEOINT 2012 Symposium features speakers from the defense, intelligence, and homeland security communities, as well as panel discussions and breakout tracks tackling the critical issues affecting our national security. Network with professionals and uncover new technologies from more than 250 organizations. Register and learn more at GEOINT2012.com. That's GEOINT2012.com.
The men and women of our National Guard and Reserve Forces are working hard on the battlefield and here at home. Employer support of the Guard and Reserve is working just as hard for them. For over 36 years, ESGR has paved the way for greater understanding between our Guard and Reserve Forces and their civilian employers, promoting a culture where all American employers support and honor the military service of their employees. Together, we all serve. To learn more, visit www.esgr.mil.
Today's Human Capital Management Report brought to you by the Graduate School.
The federal government is making it easier for some feds to volunteer. The Office of Personnel Management is encouraging all agencies to offer time off and other workplace flexibilities to employees in the science, technology, engineering, and math fields. The administration wants feds to use the volunteer time to get kids involved in the sciences. OPM also hopes the program will help recruit young people into federal service.
Expertise, innovation, and customer service. Just a few of the reasons why the federal government has turned to Graduate School USA for its training needs for over 90 years. Graduate School USA offers hundreds of courses and customized programs to help your agency address today's challenges. Its training center is conveniently located by L'Enfant Metro, and on-site programs are available as well. Call 888-744-GRAD or visit graduateschool.edu for more information.
Nuclear Regulatory Commission staff are riding out Hurricane Isaac at power plants in the eye of the storm. I'm Emily Kopp. On Friday's Federal Drive, we'll learn how the NRC is applying lessons from Japan's Fukushima meltdown. And Health and Human Services uses Maine for a testbed of health information exchanges. It all starts at 6 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And for the latest federal news, check out federalnewsradio.com.
This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest on Industry Chatter today is Mark Weber, president of the U.S. public sector for NetApp. And you mentioned before the break that it is impossible to predict how much data someone will be dealing with a year from now. Is there anything beyond guessing? Are there any cues that you can take? Are there any predictors? Certainly it can't be done, as you said, in a definitive way. But is there any guidance available at all, or is it really just catch as catch can?
Well, history is always a good indicator, so you'll look back, but history has its problem with data because historical data was much more structured. The future data has got a lot more unstructured data in it, a lot more voice, a lot more video, and you didn't have that in the historic. So that's pretty tough to predict, right? And, you know, the changing missions, right? I mean, there's a lot of missions that change a lot. So I think there's people that do a good job, but then, you know, it is a guesswork, right? It's no science to it. It's an art, you know?
Yeah. If you don't know what you're going to be dealing with a year from now and 2 years from now, how do you plan for that and how do you strategize for it?
Well, you see a lot of people clearly will then overbuy, right? Buy more than they need. And then it sits there in what we call white space, meaning it's not used. It's just storage waiting to be filled up. But you do see a bunch of people doing some storage on demand opportunities too. You see where they'll provision storage from a vendor like NetApp as demand increases, right? So they'll create a contract with a company like us or some other partner, and they'll add storage monthly or quarterly to their floor, mm-hmm. right? So then you're not wasting it, right?
How is that different than anything else as a service, or is it just the same thing?
It's similar, but you also then don't have an asset there, and you're not paying for an asset until you use that asset. So government's pretty good at writing contracts that are favorable to them and not paying for something until they use it. And so we've seen some creative contracting in that. Now, not everybody's taking advantage of that, but I think it's a good methodology for all of us to play in.
But I hear a lot from people on the IT side at the agencies that it is difficult for them to get their procurement shops into the mindset of being able to buy on a subscription or on-demand type basis. Are you seeing that changing, or are you not experiencing that from your side?
100%, Francis, that's accurate, right? I mean, there's the aggressive, and I don't mean illegal, but aggressive procurement people that try new things that are clearly ways to save the government money, and then there's the guys that
just want
that's
to do
not
it the way
we do it, right? It's not on GSA or hadn't been done for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So mostly it's the end user trying to change the behavior in procurement,
yeah.
But it can be done. It can.
Do you see initiatives like the Cloud First Initiative, although it doesn't deal directly with what you're doing, does that contribute to the mindset change that we're talking about?
Well, sure. I mean, that's a nice umbrella policy, you know, let's look at cloud, right? And that does affect us. It affects a company like NetApp a lot because if they go look at the cloud, then I used to sell to the Army. Well, now you got to go convince the cloud provider to use your architecture with the Army, right? So who myself and my peers are selling to and convincing our architectures to write changes. But that's a good thing, right? I mean, it keeps us competitive.
Mm-hmm. What kind of policies or what kind of initiatives or what kind of guidance on big data would you like to see agencies be able to have to work with?
So, again, I'm a vendor. We provide great products. So I'm not going to set policies for the government. We give them some guidance. But in general, I believe as a supplier of technology, our job is to make sure the government's looking at how they buy product and not look at the old ways, but look at the new ways. And what I mean by that is I mentioned something, a terabyte is not a terabyte from anybody. So you can't just put out a solicitation and say, I want to buy 100 terabytes, because that's not the same. So if you're looking at it, this government needs to look at what's the most efficient use of the storage, what kind of technology comes with that to be able to dedupe, clone the data, provision a different way, migrate it to different tiers. So those are all things that are going to save the federal government tons of money and be more efficient. Again, it's a procurement strategy that they have to look at best value, not just the lowest price disk drive and software out there, right? Does that make sense?
And it sounds like it's right in the pocket of what MythBusters was all about, which is have these conversations with the vendors before you put out the RFPs so that you know exactly what it is, what that's possible, so that you're not asking, and use the example that you gave, you're not asking for a terabyte, you're not asking for a particular item, but you're asking for a solution to the problem that you have.
That is correct. We've seen some procurements that say we need to store, and I'm just using an example, 100 terabytes of email data, right? But they don't tell you how much storage you have to sell them to do that. So if I can do that by deduping or, other technologies and only need to sell them 50 terabytes, that's acceptable. Now I'm held accountable to be able to, store that 100 terabytes of email, right? Mm-hmm. So again, it's a different procurement thought. They just say the mission, the objective is to store 100 terabytes, but it doesn't say you have to provide all that. Does that make sense?
Yes,
right?
It does.
So you have to be creative, and contracting plays a huge role in getting the best value here.
Are we trending in the right direction at the agencies? Are you seeing more agencies that are willing and able to be creative in the ways that you're talking about?
The answer is always yes, but it's always a small margin.
Mm-hmm.
There's a certain percentage to do a great job, but I think the answer keeps getting a bigger yes, because once somebody does it and they see it done successfully, other people follow. But also, money's everything, and the agencies won't have as much money going forward, potentially with the budget issues. So they have to get creative.
Mm-hmm.
They've got a problem. They've got to store a certain amount of data or do certain things. Without the money, they got to get creative.
A number of your peers have said that they believe that this money situation will turn out to be, in some ways, a blessing in disguise for agencies, because it'll force them to do things that they maybe should have done before right along these lines, and now they kind of have to, whether they want to or not.
You know, I'm not a guy. I've been selling to the federal government a long time. I'm not a guy that really perfectly ever reads the federal budget. I don't. You know why? Because I believe the best products from my company or my peer companies are usually going to win. So if you got $1 or $2, sometimes, you know, data center consolidation or different things make them get more efficient. And I think the best technology then wins more often than when they have more money. Right? So my company's had huge growth in the federal government because we offer a great value, right?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, and that's. But that statement's coming at a time when I'm hearing more vendors say, "I'm not able to sell the government on value anymore. Their price is the consideration more than value now." And agencies are getting less creative at discerning value and more willing to go directly to price. If for no other reason than it's less easy to protest an award based on price.
Sure, we see those situations. But I can tell you, when you go buy from a cloud vendor, right, or buy from an integrator who's going to do a storage on demand service, what are they going to do? They're going to buy the best price, or are they going to buy the most efficient IT solution? I still think the most efficient and the most cost effective is going to win. I do.
Mark Weber is the president of U.S. Public Sector for NetApp, my guest on Industry Chatter on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Our conversation continues in just a moment.
This week's Experts in Health topic is high blood pressure, featuring Dr. John Golden, chief of cardiology with the Mid-Atlantic Permanente Medical Group, who practices at Kaiser Permanente's new Tyson's Corner Medical Center.
Hypertension, or high blood pressure, is a major risk factor for stroke and heart disease, the leading cause of death in the U.S. Hi, I'm Dr. Golden. Nearly 1 in 3 U.S. adults has high blood pressure, and many are unaware of it. At Kaiser Permanente, we actively screen for and initiate treatment plans to control high blood pressure. We are the top performer in the region for controlling high blood pressure among our members. Our physicians provide comprehensive care to our members, so it's no surprise that Kaiser Permanente outperforms all the other local plans in quality measures, according to the Maryland Healthcare Commission's 2011 Health Benefit Plan Performance Report.
Dr. Golden was recognized as a top doctor in the Washingtonian and Northern Virginia magazines. Visit kp.org/midatlantic and click Meet Our Doctors, controlling high blood pressure rate as reported in HEDIS 2011.
Here's David Fricke, CEO of ECO Electric, from the Sustainability and Energy Efficiency in the Federal Government panel.
In the early 2000s, it was largely started by corporate initiatives and goals to just simply reduce utility costs. But in the last 3 years, we've seen some fabulous projects. We're the guys in the trenches. We're the guys that implement the policy and try to come up with creative solutions for achieving these goals.
To listen to the whole program, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
By 2015, federal mandates dictate that government facilities must reduce their energy usage by 30%. As a U.S.-based company, Lutron Electronics is proud to partner with the U.S. government to provide energy-saving solutions compliant with the Buy American Act that'll help the government achieve its aggressive energy reduction goals. To experience the benefits of Lutron light control, visit the D.C. Experience Center at 455 Massachusetts Avenue Northwest, Suite 770. Email dcexperience@lutron.com for more information.
There are those who dedicate themselves to a sense of honor, to a life of courage, and a commitment to something greater than themselves. They have always defended this nation and each other. They still do. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Actively controlling inflammation. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Ira Dreyfuss with HHS HealthBeat. Physical activity seems to rein in proteins that indicate inflammation, which is good because sustained higher levels of those proteins indicate a higher risk of heart disease. And a study finds that people who exercised regularly had lower levels of the blood markers C-reactive protein and interleukin-6. At University College London, Mark Hamer saw that in 10 years of data on almost 4,300 people.
Those people that were consistently active across the 10 years demonstrated lower levels of inflammatory markers.
Hamer says consistent, moderate to vigorous activity, enough to leave you slightly sweaty, was enough. The study in the journal Circulation was supported by the National Institutes of Health. Learn more at healthfinder.gov. HHS HealthSpeed is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Ira Dreyfuss.
Learn to navigate through IT, budget, acquisition, and leadership challenges. Meet other senior leaders from government and industry at the 2012 Executive Leadership Conference, hosted by the American Council for Technology and Industry Advisory Council. This year's program covers mobility, big data, workforce, and government optimization. Join them October 28th through 30th in Williamsburg. Register now at actgov.org/ELC2012. That's actgov.org/ELC2012. Listen each week for Tech Tuesday on Federal News Radio. Every Tuesday, we zero in on how technology inspires innovation. Tuesday mornings at 11, it's Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy, the latest on products that help bring policy to life. Then Tuesday afternoons at 12:30, join Federal News Radio's Jason Miller for Ask the CIO. Hear from the top of the food chain on how your agency is using technology today. Tech Tuesday, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Mark Weber is the president of the U.S. public sector for NetApp, my guest on Industry Chatter today. We've talked a lot about big data so far. What is the biggest misconception that people have about big data right now? What is the thing that people should understand and maybe don't enough about big data and dealing with it?
Well, I think when people say big data, first of all, they're staying up at the 10,000-foot level. This is a solvable problem. Right? I mean, anytime something's got huge growth opportunities, this country, this technology industry that we have in this country solves those problems. Because, one, there's innovation going to happen and there's money to be made. So I think it's just a huge opportunity. So I guess the answer to your question would be people just need to tackle it. And whatever solution they come up with today is clearly going to evolve and change over the next many years as innovation happens in this area, as we learn how to mine and, you know, tap into the unstructured data and not keep all that, but keep the good pieces of it. That's huge innovation, Francis.
Is right? Is that unstructured data and dealing with it the major place for innovation in the big data realm, do you think?
Well, it's clearly one. Like I said, there's three aspects. We look at big data and the analytics, you know, how to mine this data, get the best out of it, is clearly one of those. You know, but the side you're talking about is the content side. How do you store this volume of data? Well, there's a ton of innovation that needs to happen so you don't have to store all of it, right? And how do you dedupe video, right? How do you not keep it all? So there's innovation in the A, in the C, the content, and then the bandwidth. It's coming at people way too fast. They don't have systems big enough or enough systems to capture it. So there's innovation in the bandwidth side, too, as to how do you lay this data out there and how do you get to it quickly? So I think it's all three of what we call the ABCs of big data. You got innovation. But the analytics side in the federal government will be huge, too. The other side, I think, will come from the IT communities, right? The product providers will solve a lot of the content, you know, because that's what we do, and a lot of the bandwidth. But the analytics, you know, a lot of the federal contractors will solve those problems.
How much of that, of the analytics part of it, either is or will be automatable? Will it be ways for, you're talking about deduping video as being a big challenge. How much of that will be able to be automated? It's either now or at some point.
You know, I think like anything, you'll see levels of applications from industry, right? You'll get, you know, some generic virtualization piece of software. But then after you get past that, you'll need specific silos, right? So there'll still be a lot of opportunities for people to solve intelligence agency analytics, very specific to the type of data, you know, where it's coming from, what to do with it. So I think there's a lot of innovation in the stovepipes, but you'll see a lot of good generic layers of innovation. We see it. We're investing in that.
Now, agencies are asking for innovation, but they're not always specific about where they want to see innovation. How do you decide which areas of these are the places that you want to focus your R&D? Is it just a pure business play, or is there some kind of other development process as far as where you want to focus whatever the next level or layer of innovation is going to be?
Right. So, you know, like I said, NetApp's a $7 billion growth company, pretty, you know, 25% type growth company. So we're spending about $1.3 billion, $1.4 billion in R&D. Half of that goes into technology to store less data, because we believe, and again, this is not a NetApp pitch, but we believe the guys who innovate and can store less data, hence be more efficient, more cost effective, are going to win, right? The best ROI typically ends up winning. So that's kind of where we're focused on. So we have to innovate on how to get efficient on storing data. Our peer companies, you know, will focus on other layers. So we're a storage and data management company. Somebody else will go into the analytics and, you know, the higher level layers of that.
And so, then I see the connection based on where your focus on R&D is, why you place the importance on the creativity and the contracting at the agencies. Because if these procurements are coming straight out for X amount of storage, that's, you're not going to be able to demonstrate
the value prop of the guys who are innovating, and it's not just NetApp, but they're, you know, my peer competitors, they're spending a lot of R&D and innovating, right? So, like I said, a terabyte from me is probably not the same as a terabyte from your local electronics store, right?
What's the education process like for you to go into agencies in both the IT shop and the procurement shop and educate them on this very issue?
Well, particularly in the federal government, I run other pieces other than just federal, so it's a little different in those other segments. But in the federal government, we like to say 75% of our job is selling our value to the end user, the guy who has the money, the CIO, whoever that is. But probably 25% of my sales team's job is the procurement side, right? Understanding what contracts, how to get it purchased, right? And helping our customer do that. There's a lot of great contracts to use. Some of them are hard, some of them are easier. If you look at the commercial side, you know, me selling, my team sells to the healthcare world, it's probably more like 95% of my job is selling to the end user and the CIO, and minimal at the procurement shop, because they're taking direction more from the IT shop on procurement. So it makes sense? I mean,
yes.
Probably not far off from what you've heard from other people.
You say that there are a lot of great contracts out there. Are there too many? Are there too many vehicles that you as a company have to be? Because I imagine you want to be on all of them. So if somebody wants to buy something, they're going to be able to do it no matter how they want to do it.
So, you know, our approach is not dissimilar from other IT companies. NetApp uses partners to sell a lot of our product to the government, okay? So yes, I want to be on those contracts, but really I want my products on those contracts. So, you know, my products are held by a lot of the resellers and a lot of the integrators, so that gives me a much broader ability to get on all those contracts, because I'm taking NetApp and now going to, you know, 20 partners or 50, whatever the number we have, so they all have vehicles. Does that make sense?
It does.
And so my ability, now I'm coaching them on, I don't have the ITES 3 contract yet. That's up for compete, right?
Right.
And I want my partners to go after that. But you bet. Being on vehicles is critical.
I want to talk about that partnership relationship and how you develop them and what makes a good partner and all those kinds of things when we come back.
You bet.
My guest is Mark Weber. He's president of the U.S. public sector for NetApp on Industry Chatter on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
This is NIH Health Matters. I'm Joe Belinfi. Scientists have crystallized several types of opioid receptors, which are proteins in the brain that modulate mood and pain perception. Dr. Gene Chin at the NIH says crystallization enables scientists to take pictures of the receptors so that their structures can be studied.
A picture is worth a thousand words. Everyone says that, and it's really true. But, you know, we have to keep in mind that it's only one picture. What you really want is a movie.
Dr. Chin adds the pictures could help scientists understand why some opioid-based drugs like morphine and heroin have the potential to become addictive. For more information on opioid receptors, visit www.nigms.nih.gov. Health Matters is produced by the National Institutes of Health, part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
$1.2 trillion in across-the-board spending cuts are set to hit federal agencies starting January 2nd. What programs will be affected, and how are agencies preparing? Will federal employees be furloughed? And how will contractors handle the funding reductions? The clock is ticking. Congress has 4 months to agree on alternative cuts before sequestration becomes a reality. Find the latest news at federalnewsradio.com/sequestration.
Newsmakers on In Depth with Francis Rose.
Defense Logistics Agency Vice Admiral Mark Hernacek.
When you look at a microcircuit, it has markings that say exactly what it is. We are now requiring our contractors to mark that with DNA. So what happens is you'll get a microcircuit with a DNA marking, and you do nothing more than shine that little light on it that your average TSA person has at the airport. And if the light shines the right way, it's DNA marked, and it's ready to go. And if it doesn't, there's probably a problem with it.
FederalNewsRadio.com/in-depth.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Mark Weber of NetApp is my guest on Industry Chatter today. And you mentioned in the last segment partnerships a couple of times. And I want to know what you think a good partner is for your company on both sides of the fence. How does a good partner serve you? And how do you prefer to serve a good partner as opposed to somebody who is not as easy to work with, or you don't work with as often, or whatever?
You bet. So allow me restate that we probably do 95% of our business with partners. So that's the contracting piece. But we also expect our partners to create demand for our products. We don't view our partners as just contract and vehicle fulfillment. We expect them to learn our product, be trained on it, and their salespeople and their engineers know our value proposition. And for that, like anything, Francis, you know, they would make profit by selling our product, right? I mean, it's a give to get world, right? And so we expect them to understand our architecture. We don't expect total loyalty, but it's tough to go into a place and sell four flavors of storage and say, which one do you want? Because that's not a lot of loyalty, and how can they know the best value for the customer? So many of my partners do sell other storage products, but most lead with NetApp because, by the way, that's how they get sales, right? Because they know they're loyal to one product, they'll know it better. So
the relationship building in partnerships that you're engaged in, what does that look like? How personal do those relationships get? What does a good relationship building situation look like to you?
Well, you know, we view them as part of our family. Our partners are an extension to NetApp, right? We treat them. They go to the same training we do. They're in our facility all the time. So there's nothing that they don't have access to that my employees don't have access to. So they're kind of an extension of NetApp. And when we say partnered, I should say that's your typical reseller, VAR, whatever term you want to use. But 40% of our business goes through systems integrators, you know, your big defense-type contractors. So you wouldn't think are typically that loyal to one product. But once they do something with maybe my product or my competitors, with my product in particular, and they do it really well and they're very efficient, they get pretty loyal to it because then they know how to do it really well the next time. Hence, they have to bid less services and they're more competitive.
Yeah, people hesitate to make changes if they don't have to. So I guess when they get on a track in a particular way and it works, it makes sense to keep going
right.
The same
and,
way.
So we spend a lot of time training our partners and treating them like their partner NetApp. And I think that's what they like. Our, you know, NetApp was rated number one best place to work 2 years ago in the United States. So we have a very good, healthy culture, and our partners want to be part of that.
Mm-hmm.
So.
How much of that do you think is visible to your end customer in the government?
You know, you might think we're in the technology business, and we have to out-innovate everybody, because I do believe the best product usually wins. But this is a people business. The stuff we sell takes smart people to implement and get what I call the value out of what we sell. If you just turn it on and you turn on two features, you know, you wasted your money, Francis, because you need to turn on all the features to get the value out of it. And it takes people, the best people, to do that. And I don't mean my people. I mean the customer. So I mean both. My people have to go train the trainer and get them on, you know, get them smart. We always say the smartest customers are our best, right? Because they get the value out of it and it works better, right? Mm. So I think culture and people get us a ton of business.
What is the next step in the evolutionary process for big data? Where do we go from where we are today? How does the big data field look different a year from now or 2 years from now or 5 years from now than it does today?
I think it's R&D and innovation. I think people see, first of all, people don't talk about CPUs as much as they talk about data. Right. And forget that underneath that data is storage for a second. Yes, I work for a storage company, but the data is what we're all talking about. How do you get value out of that? It's either going to hurt you because you got too much data and you know what to do with it, or it's going to add huge value. And for that, people are going to innovate because whoever gets the most value is going to be the most efficient, save money, whatever the metrics are, Francis. I just think innovation is going to win this business. Right. And innovation usually gets you revenue, right? So where you see defense contractors innovating in big data, they're going to create whole new business areas, one being cyber, right? You know, lots of areas. But
the contraction of the top lines at agencies, how is that impacting how a company like yours does business and plans and strategizes?
Well, sure. We're the number one provider to the government, so budgets will matter. If I was a little guy, I'd say I could sell around it, but budgets will matter. But again, I think they still have a job to do. I don't think that job's going to change. That mission's not going to change or get smaller. So IT's only going to play a more efficient role in how they get their job done. So I fear budgets, but I don't worry about it. It is what it is. You know, they'll have X amount of money, and we'll do everything we can to help solve their problem in the budget they're given.
You've right? been in the government market long enough to have been through a couple of these kinds of cycles. Do you view this as just another cycle that we're going through, or is this a new normal kind of scenario in your opinion?
You know, it's a fact of life. We're overspending. But again, I'm not a politician or any of those things, so I'm not going to go down too much of that. But, you know, sequestration is a word everybody gets fearful of. But I think it's an irrational way to look at cutting the budget. But I think it's done on purpose, right? To make some rational decisions, right?
It's supposed to be a forcing mechanism.
Right, if you don't have something irrational, yes. then you won't come up with something rational, meaning what should we really cut, mm-hmm. right? So I don't think we'll end up doing it that way. I hope not. But I do think it'll create people at the table to solve the problem or start solving the problem.
One of the biggest problems that IT people in government tell me is that they are so wrapped up in whatever compliance they have to do or whatever projects are in front of them that they don't have much time to visualize the possible, to think about the possible. I want to talk to you about that to wrap up our conversation when we come back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Mark Weber of NetApp is my guest on Industry Chatter today. Back in a moment.
Conducting the business of government has never been more challenging, as agencies need to make even smarter procurement decisions. Now you can take the direct path to successful acquisitions with GSA's multiple award schedules. GSA makes it easier to get what you need, when you need it, on time and on budget. You'll save time and money by reducing costly delays in purchasing services and products, with the flexibility and control you need to negotiate better prices. Pricing. GSA also provides best value through established contracts with pre-qualified vendors and streamlined access to a wide selection of contractors. You can also create blanket purchase agreements to meet your agency's recurring requirements. To find out how GSA's multiple award schedules can help you support your agency's needs, visit gsa.gov/ACQCPM. That's gsa.gov/ACQCPM.
These days, federal agencies are exploring how to be more efficient, from cutting hidden costs to operating differently. Turn to Deloitte. We blend public sector experience and private sector insights to help defense and civilian agencies rethink, reduce, and restructure, all while strengthening your mission, so you can stretch budgets more and your staff less. See how at Deloitte.com/federal. We help government help America.
Welcome to today's lottery drawing. And today's winning numbers are not yours, not yours, and another number that's not yours. And the final number is not yours.
When it comes to having money, don't rely on luck. Brew your own coffee at home instead of buying that latte. Brown bag it to work instead of ordering it. Go to feedthepig.org for more free ideas on how to save.
Feedthepig.org.
This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
Are you a skilled IT professional looking to be called by your first name instead of your employee number? If so, Preferred Systems Solutions is calling your name. Since 1991, PSS has offered customers and employees the attention of a small business while delivering capabilities of a large enterprise. With contracts across the DoD, civilian, and intelligence communities, PSS offers opportunities in ERP, intelligence, IT, and program management. PSS offers a dynamic workplace, competitive compensation, and best-in-class benefits. To join their team, visit PSSFed.com and click Career.
What is required to secure America's technological frontier? Join National Journal and Government Executive as they kick off Cybersecurity Month on September 28th with a one-day event at the museum. The Cyber Summit features an unparalleled program exploring the latest developments in protecting our national security, critical networks, and digital information. Engage with top leaders in policy and implementation at this high-impact event. For details, visit cyber-summit.com.
This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Mark Weber is president of the U.S. public sector for NetApp. He's my guest on Industry Chatter today. Mark, one of the things that IT people in government tell me all the time is I am so focused on what I'm doing today that I'm not always aware of all of the possibilities out there. Now, you and I have talked about this a little bit in understanding the possibilities in analytics and just being able to educate oneself on the different things that can happen. What are some things that you see on the horizon that maybe an IT pro in government doesn't need to know about today, but should be aware of that as they start to manifest themselves a year or 2 years or so from now, somebody's not surprised by the fact that something is right up on top of them?
You bet, Francis. I mean, I'll start off with an example. Everybody knows the server virtualization kind of changed the industry and the ability to get way more efficient with your servers. Well, storage, there's some of that, but still you buy storage for an email solution or a big data problem or a database. You still have, you know, application-specific type storage. Even though it's on the network, it's still targeted at apps. What you see now is what we call, we use the term agile data infrastructure. And what I refer to there is basically virtualization of storage. So think of that as now you'll be able to have kind of an infinite storage. So you used to look at your assets in different silos. Now you'll look at your storage assets across your whole community, whether that's an agency or department, as one infinite group of storage, and you'll be able to move data around very simply, just like you do with server applications, and just pick up data and move it, and then you'll be able to take that storage unit offline. So we kind of look at it as an infinite scaling, and then that makes it be able to be immortal, right? I mean, the virtualization on the server side doesn't usually go down if one server goes down. So right now in the storage world, you'll be able to not go down because you'll be able to have this infinite scaling. We kind of call it immortal, right? If one unit goes down, you just move that data and pluck it over to another. And we've talked a lot about kind of the third eye we look at in this new architectural methodology is intelligent. Right, is how efficient and how much really the mining of that data you're going to get. So the simple term would be storage virtualization. We call it agile data infrastructure. And basically, it's infinite scaling and immortal.
Also, looking forward, what do you think, how do you think your company will look differently, if at all, a year or 2 years from now compared to how it looks today?
Well, NetApp's an independent storage company. So, you know, there's a lot of storage you can buy from server type companies. But what's happened is most people still buy their IT product from the most innovative company. So I think our company will continue to be an independent storage company, and so will my peer companies, because it is 40 bordering on close to 50% of your IT spend these days. So it is a critical asset to protect your data. So I think you know, storage is going to be a big growth industry, and data management particularly is going to be a huge growth.
You mentioned before we went on the air that the U.S. public sector for NetApp encompasses not just the federal government, but also state and local governments, education, and you told me also healthcare. Are there lessons that federal government people can learn from those other sectors about how to deal with big data that maybe they're not onto yet?
You bet. But I think it's on both sides. There's state and local that learn from the federal, but then, you know, a lot of the state and local government problems are smaller, right? So you can put your arms around their problem. It's pretty hard to put your arms around some of our intelligence agency problems, right? So there's lessons to be learned on both sides, but you do see a lot more sharing between those organizations, between state sharing with what federal's doing, because a lot of that money flows back and forth too. And where money goes, people talk.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the lessons that you think people at the federal level could take from some of your customers at the state and local level?
Well, clearly, you know, policy, right? It's tough to form policy at the federal level because it's broad and a lot of people have an opinion. If you go to a local government, it's not a whole lot of people who have to make that policy decision. And by the way, their policy decisions, or even at the state level, aren't going to be much different than the federal, right? So, but there's just fewer cooks in the kitchen so they can get it done faster. So I think if they look at how those policy decisions have been made, you know, probably 95% of what they've decided is pretty accurate. So that's just one example we see there, being able to get those decisions done quicker.
Mark, I appreciate you being here today. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks,
Francis,
for your time.
Thanks
today
for having us on, and NetApp really appreciates you having us.
Happy to do it. Mark Weber is the president of the U.S. public sector for NetApp. My conversation with him will be posted at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. Coming next on In Depth with Francis Rose, hour number two of the program. We'll be right back.